invited testimony from a myriad of folks that I am delighted and proud to have here. By way of an announcement, I just want everyone to know I've got, well, let's put it this way. I've been summoned to the speaker's office at 3:45. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I will certainly be there, and no disrespect intended to our distinguished guests. Well, based on your track record of prognostication, Representative March, I feel quite comfortable that that's how you feel things are going.
Mr. Chair, I just think when I just left the Speaker's office and we spent 20 minutes discussing you, you're in serious trouble.
I thought it could have been worse than that, so I'm fairly relieved.
Kitty, you're okay.
Let me have Mr. Bogovian say a few words, and then we'll get right to the hearing.
Thank you, Chair. Just FYI, in front of you is a blue folder. These are materials from Bob DePreet and Bruce Goldberg that are follow-up from a presentation they gave a while back. So these are just not part of the presentation today.
Okay, excellent. Let's get right to it then. We'll call people up in sort of panels, as we're used to discussing in this committee. So to begin with, we'll have Ellen Pinney and Arthur Towers. And
that's it.
And that's
Arthur Towers.
Oh, in one panel?
Yes.
Well, you got to explain this to me. I mean, that three is a big number. Also from the Safety Net Coalition, John Duke. Excuse me, sir. I've hand scribbled notes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ellen Kinney.
You're doing pretty good, but if you could get real friendly with those microphones, and they actually pull out of the witness stand, you just grab it right by the.
Oh, you want me to?
I mean, to pull it out. To pull the cord out, just pull it right. Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. I wasn't articulating very well. Excuse me.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ellen Pinney. I'm executive director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I really want to thank you, Representative Westland, for acknowledging the need to engage consumers and those that serve their needs and the process of helping to revise and redefine the Oregon Health Plan. Oregon Health Action Campaign is a coalition of individuals and organizations. We are committed to empowering the consumer voice in the development of health systems that give all people access to the care they need when they need it from providers of their choice at an affordable cost. We believe healthcare is a right. We believe that we probably share your amazement and frustration that with all the resources dedicated to healthcare in this country, over $1 trillion, we do not have the best healthcare system in the world. In fact, in our state, as you well know, people are dying because of a lack of access. I also find it ironic that I put some buttons on your desk, Cover the Uninsured Week. Representative Bates helped launch that effort up in Portland, and it's somewhat ironic that while the nation's attention is focused on covering the uninsured, we have a growing number of very vulnerable underinsured in this state. We were active in the development of the Oregon Health Plan and specifically worked on the requirement that all employers contribute to health care for their workers' independence. It is our belief that this program was never intended to be publicly funded only. It was always intended to be a public-private partnership. And I think we'll get back to that when we discuss revenue options. We also were very strongly supportive of the theory that this plan was to set a standard for private insurance, that the benefits package for people on Medicaid was to set a standard for private insurance. It was never intended to be a benefits experiment for only the poor. And we appreciated and were involved with ensuring that there was an open public process for the plan development and implementation. Oregon Health Plan was important to members of our coalition for other reasons. It delinked welfare from health care. It made access to publicly funded programs a right for people less than the federal, with incomes below the federal poverty level. It held out the promise of universal coverage. It promised to pay providers at cost. And in doing so, it would help eliminate and reduce, or reduce, I should say, the cost shift, or as I understand Ruth Shepherd told you, the cost shaft, which Representative Westland shared at our membership council meeting. And that is the cost shaft of caring for the uninsured to the private market, the cost shift of the under-reimbursed providers to the private market, and the cost shift of unmet health needs to the criminal justice, juvenile justice, and educational systems. And as the benefits list developed, there was a clear statement that prevention should be the number one priority of our health market or of our health delivery system, and that mental health could not be separated from physical health. But prevention has not what has been emphasized in the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan. Our original overarching concern about the plan was that this prioritized list of benefits was going to leave out benefits vital to the needs of the most vulnerable, whose particular service might cost a lot of money but only be applicable to a handful of people. But that has not been the biggest problem for enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan. The biggest problem to date remains access. Access to providers who will accept Medicaid cards, access to the program itself, the process of enrollment is an enormous barrier. Access to services when you are asked to pay copays and premiums you cannot afford, the access challenges faced by enrollees as their plans and providers turn in and out of the market, and now access to services that are desperately needed and no longer funded by the Oregon Health Plan. In order to understand how to improve the Oregon Health Plan, particularly for those who currently are eliminated from, who are being considered to be eliminated from the 0305 biennium, namely the OHP standard population, it's important to understand what we learned when in the waiver application steering committee, that 40% of that population of OHP standard lives with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. While much has been made of rebuilding the Oregon Health Plan to make it look more like the private market, I would submit to you that the majority of Oregon Health Plan enrollees, including those in the standard plan, are not served by private market lookalike products. They can't afford copays. They can't afford premiums. They can't make it to clinics within the traditional 8-hour workday. They can't make it across town when they're enrolled in a managed care plan where the delivery system that they are intended to go to or are directed to go to is across town. In fact, this population needs, and we hope that for the standard population, particularly those who are most low income, you recognize the need for mental health and chemical dependency services. Because we believe that the Oregon Health Plan remains one of the legs of universal access, it's also important to understand who's not enrolled. 420,000 uninsured Oregonians, 150,000 people estimated to be eligible but not enrolled, over 100,000 children uninsured. Robert Wood Johnson suggests, in fact, that in this country, 64% of the nation's uninsured children are eligible for but not enrolled in state publicly funded health programs, and that's because of the enrollment and application barriers.
That's 64%?
64%.
And I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the last one. 64% because of?
64%, and Robert Wood Johnson would suggest that the reasons that those children are not enrolled is because there's not enough aggressive outreach, because the application itself is too complicated. I'll give you an example. In Oregon, you have to re-enroll every 6 months. There's lots of documentation, including an assets test. Many states have chosen to go to a one-page application for children. They have eliminated assets tests for children. And particularly in Oregon right now, Representative Bates, we are concerned that as the standard adult population loses their coverage, that children have a right to continue their enrollment, but families will not be informed that their children remain eligible even when the adults cannot pay premiums. And it would be one of our focuses to try to ensure that the state does everything within its power to maintain the enrollment for those children.
Would you also agree with the statement that there's a lack of revenue to get the F-CHIP, and that there has been a concern at the state level about the woodwork effect of enrolling children and their parents becoming eligible, and that's held us back from going where we need to go and should have gone?
Representative Westland, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I would agree with you that one of the concerns is the Woodwork effect, that for every child we enroll in CHIP, in fact, I believe three people enroll in the Medicaid program. I don't believe there is a lack of revenue. I believe there's a lack of political will to come up with the revenue. Okay. And we will offer some suggestions for how that might be approached, as a matter of fact.
I would agree with that statement. Okay.
And one thing, Ellen, just to underscore, Representative Cruz invited his committee, of which I'm a member, and we went toured DHS just the other day, and it was very enlightening. And here are these noble souls, I classify them as, in this. This isn't the nice fancy building, you know, on the Capitol Mall here. I mean, this is the one in North Salem. And the here they are in this, it must be 7-foot high ceiling, dark. I think the ventilation was okay. But they are, it's very difficult working conditions, and they're the ones that process the up to 3,300 applications they get a day. And that form has gone from 4 pages when OHP was initiated to 10 pages today. And I looked at that, and just the capacity for error, not to mention this fairly onerous process that clients have to go through, it was very eye-opening to me. Anyway, I digress. I just wanted to underscore your point.
Representative Westland, I don't think that's a digression at all. I think that's precisely the work that we are engaged in. I wanted to share with you that our coalition is the recipient of the Covering Kids and Families grant from Robert Wood Johnson, which is designed to ensure that eligible and insured children and families have access to publicly funded programs. We operate a helpline that we advertise as an application assistance tool. We work hand-in-hand with the folks at OHP Central, and recognize that 40% of the applications sent there are pended for more information, and that is precisely because of the complexity of the application itself. I can give you specific examples, but we were hoping actually to have that discussion on a separate day. If you'd like me to talk about that, I'd be happy to do so.
No, continue with your prepared testimony.
Thank you. I wanted to suggest to you that this is not the time to be seeking additional and more creative ways of cutting Medicaid, but in fact to find the resolve to raise the revenues necessary to support it and draw down the federal match, which is an economic stimulus for the state in and of itself, even without the jobs and additional revenue it creates. We urge you to build resolve within yourselves and in your communities and within these halls to support increased revenues for this program. You, more than your constituents, more than many others in this building, know the pain and see the death and pending disaster for thousands of Oregonians. Please don't let their voices drift away. Bring them home to your community and build consensus for the need for new revenues. We offer some suggestions for Oregon health plan improvement that are based on the following assumptions. It's healthy for Oregon's economy to maximize the health of all Oregonians and to draw down the federal match that helps make that possible. That access to services starting with prevention is essential for Oregon health plan enrollees. That once you set the line on whoever is eligible, all efforts should be made to enroll and maintain enrollment for those eligible. Enrollment for those eligible should be straightforward and simple. Turning in and out of coverage and plans is not cost-effective. If Oregon doesn't pay up front for health services, we will pay in other ways that are much more expensive. And we believe that expanding the pool of Oregon health plan enrollees will increase provider participation and lower per capita costs. So here are our suggestions. There should be no premiums for people living below the federal poverty level. We understand that with the changes in OHP standard, there is a projection that 70,000 out of the 110,000 currently enrolled will disenroll over the next few months simply because they cannot pay their premiums and their copays. There is mass confusion among enrollees and the people who serve their needs, in fact, about how these changes in the Oregon Health Plan are going to come down and impact their access. That includes copays, the ability of providers to deny those who can't pay copays. There should be no copayments for people living in poverty. If copayments are to be included, there should be a maximum out-of-pocket, a limit paid by each family. The six-month uninsurance waiting requirement should be reduced. It should be waived for people who are laid off because of no fault of their own and for people locked into private market plans that do not meet their needs. We believe that Oregon should follow the lead of many states and eliminate the assets test for children. There should be one toll-free number for all publicly funded programs in Oregon, FEAP, CHIP, and one assets test, which now ranges from 2 to 5 to 10, depending on the program you're in, and one-year continuous enrollment for all program. There should be a one-page application. Doctors and all primary care providers must be reimbursed that cost. The results of Oregon's evidence-based drug research should be widely advertised to all doctors and patients as a tool for improving access to the most cost-effective medications. The safety net needs to be supported, it needs to be encouraged and expanded, as should any delivery system that offers 24-hour multilingual advice nurse access. I have to really emphasize this because as a small business that does in fact provide insurance to our workers, we have a plan that gives us access to a 24-hour advice nurse, and we all use it a lot. And I don't know that Oregon Health Plan enrollees have that same kind of capacity and believe, being a mother of a young child, that it has prevented me from rushing my child to the emergency room more than once. We would like to see worker-friendly hours of operation, a community access or at least access along major transportation routes, and the ability for drop-in urgent care visits without weeks in advance appointments. Enrollees who are required to choose a managed care plan should be given immediate information about which providers are accepting new patients so that they can have access to primary care. In places where enrollees don't have access to managed care, the prescription drug copayment requirement for the Medicaid mandatory population should be eliminated. It is discriminatory, and it hits hardest on those living in parts of the state where there is no managed care plan available. We would like to encourage plans and everybody working to improve the Oregon Health Plan to seek out and nurture best methods for teaching enrollees how to utilize the system and where they can go for help. And the process should start with Oregon Health Plan enrollees with chronic health conditions. We are asking that you ensure that the voice of Oregon Health Plan enrollees and those that serve their needs is heard in every step of the process that rewrites the Oregon Health Plan. If you build a system without their input, it will not work. Acknowledge that the private insurance model does not work for people living below poverty. Do not invest public dollars in health insurance plans that do not meet benefits, out-of-pocket costs, and underwriting criteria. And I want to emphasize that while we are strongly supportive of using public money to support the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program for workers who have access to employer-based coverage, we are not supportive of using publicly funded money on private insurance products in Oregon unless the underwriting criteria changes. You can get into the individual market. You have a six-month uninsurance requirement. You might be required to wait 6 months to a year for your pre-existing condition exclusion, and that does not seem to me to be a wise use of public money. We would like to ask you to hold on to retroactive eligibility. It is the number one outreach and enrollment tool we have in this state right now. When people are sick, they come in to your clinic, they come in to the hospital emergency room, they get a date-stamped application, their eligibility starts that day. Otherwise, you lose them. We would ask you to take research and take action to secure contributions from Oregon's employers with a number of employees enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And I wanted to say this, that if obviously we are hopeful that you will reinstate health services for all of the populations that your recommendations now indicate you can't find funds for in the 03-05 biennium. And my colleague Arthur Towers is going to talk to you a little bit about some revenue options for those populations. If it comes down to having no benefits or some benefits, we are strongly supportive, and we know others have talked to you about the access model that emphasizes access to primary care and potentially does not reimburse hospitals for that population. We have worked actively in collaboration with hospitals in Marion and Polk and the Multnomah County area on what we call financial assistance charity care guidelines. And Marion and Polk County hospitals and Portland area hospitals and many others around the state have agreed to provide free care to people with incomes less than 150% of the federal poverty level, and therefore reduce the rate of bankruptcy that results from people's inability to pay medical bills. In that work,
Ellen, could I interrupt you? Excuse me. Dave, we have a special seat for you, and as is the custom of this committee, any legislator that wants to sit in, take the time, and is committed enough is welcome here, so you are more than welcome. And I'd like to point out that Representative Greenlick is just such an invitee, and we have benefited greatly from his counsel over the months now. Not that he knows anything about this subject.
I come here just to get harassed by this.
But we indulge him.
We're vice chair.
Actually, you invited Nick so it looked like I had hair.
that's what I thought. Dave, you better get out of here.
So anyway, Representative Hunt, welcome. Excuse me, please continue.
I wanted to share some insights about why we believe access to primary care and the safety net is so vital. In the Portland area, the hospitals, and John Duke, the president of the safety, or the chair of the Safety Net Coalition, is going to be talking to you shortly. Hospitals worked with the safety net to create a single application for hospital financial assistance, and we debriefed after about 6 months of hospital and safety net collaboration around making sure that clients who were eligible for the hospital financial assistance programs could actually take advantage of them and have their hospital bills forgiven. And in our research after those 6 months, we found that the unpaid debt that hospitals accrued from people who referred to them by the safety net averaged $8,000 per financial assistance application, whereas the unpaid debt of people who were not referred to them by the safety net was about $27,000 per financial assistance case. It seems clear, therefore, there are many reasons that could be true, but it seems clear that access to primary care will lower the overall financial responsibility of hospitals. And it has been one of the biggest frustrations, I believe, of my own experience with the Oregon Health Plan, that while its promise is prevention, without access to primary care, you can't. There is no prevention. I have handed
back
you,
and hear you.
I've given you a copy of our legislative agenda, which includes basically a summation of the kinds of federal revenue and jobs that will be lost in Oregon without a continuation of the programs that currently don't seem to be able to be funded. And that would be that not only 150,000 people will lose coverage, 433 million will be cut, 649 million lost in federal revenues, 13,000 jobs cut, and 1.3 billion lost in business activity. This all comes from the Families USA report that many of you have copies of, and if you don't, I'm happy to get it to you, called Medicine is Medicaid is good medicine for economies. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Ellen?
Mm-hmm.
Ellen, could you get us a bullet pointed? You went down a whole list of recommendations, you know, fairly quickly. Could you get us just a bullet-pointed list of those recommendations?
I'm delighted to do so, Representative Westland, and thank you for asking.
You bet. No, that'd be very much appreciated.
Okay, I guess I'm next. My name's Arthur Towers, and I am a board member of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, executive director of the Service Employees International Union, Oregon State Council. Thank you very much for your opportunity to testify before your committee today. Our union is concerned about the future of the Oregon Health Plan and funding for health care and long-term care for poor, elderly, and frail Oregonians. and we really want to zero in on the revenue side of the healthcare equation this afternoon. There are several solutions that can help address portions of the problems before this committee. First of all, we support the limitation of special tax exemptions granted by the state. Currently, for every dollar Oregon levies in income taxes, we only collect 55 cents. The other 45 cents are given away in the forms of deductions, credits, and exemptions. And in good economic times, that's one matter. But in our current situation, we feel that there could be a belt tightening in this area. Certainly, we've had that sort of belt tightening in the area of services. We feel that the area of tax breaks is worthy of the same level of scrutiny. If tax breaks have been held to a constant percentage of revenues over the past 2 years, state and local governments would have collected an additional $1.4 billion during the current biennium. And capping income tax breaks at 25 cents on the dollar would recover $3 billion in otherwise lost revenues for the state in the 2003-2005 biennium. And Representative Westland was kind enough to make a presentation to our group's membership meeting today and talked about the need for $150 million to restore prescriptions, chemical dependency, durable medical goods, and mental health coverage for the categorically eligible for 2003-2005. And again, just a modest change from 56 cents collected on the dollar instead of 55 cents in terms of income taxes would result in that $150 million being available. So that's a sliver of the tax breaks having a tremendous impact on the health of Oregonians. Secondly, there's a tremendous need to leverage as much federal money as possible to pay for health care costs. One possibility is to allow long-term care providers in nursing facilities to finance a quality assurance fund through an assessment that would trigger a federal match of $1.60 for every dollar raised locally. Those funds would then be used to pay for services for Medicaid recipients who need nursing care. Again, it brings in new funds for long-term care for Medicaid recipients without touching additional general fund dollars. Funds could be used to accept more Medicaid patients and to improve the quality of care in homes that serve Medicaid patients. Medicaid patients would come out ahead since there'd be more nursing home beds available and better care provided in these skilled nursing facilities. Nursing homes that accept disabled and low-income elderly would win because there'd be more funds available to care for these patients. Currently, about 75% of those homes lose money on their Medicaid patients. Caregivers would come out ahead because there'd be additional money available to ensure adequate wage levels and most importantly, adequate staffing levels. And finally, taxpayers would win because scarce general fund dollars would be conserved and new federal dollars would be pumped into the system and into local economies. It's a tool that's in place in about 20 other states. And then finally, in terms of my oral testimony, I do want to touch on medical inflation. Something that keeps coming up in terms of the various conversations around healthcare costs is that medical inflation is more or less a given. It's just like the weather. Healthcare costs are going up. Therefore, we have to cut services. We have to cut benefits for workers. We have to cut wages. But I think we ought to take a hard look at medical inflation. Pharmaceutical costs are one area that we're really concerned about. We appreciate the Attorney General's efforts to crack down on Medicaid fraud. He's won several cases in that area with the pharmaceutical companies. We hope that more can be done in that area. Finally, we also urge the formation of bulk purchasing pools to help lower the cost of prescription drugs. I'll end my testimony there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Arthur. Any questions? Representative March.
Thank you. Arthur, I know this is a little bit off subject, but client-employed providers are a big portion of our workforce in helping those who are disabled and need assistance in their homes. Do you have an idea of how many there are in Oregon and maybe what the average wage is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, there are about 13,000 client-employed providers as of January 27th. As of March 13th, I believe the number to be substantially lower. Their top-end wage is about $8.21 an hour, and that's a wage that doesn't include any benefits.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Arthur? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me before you today. I am John Duke, and I am the current chair of the statewide Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. We are a coalition of over 75 safety net clinics throughout the state, including federally qualified health centers, community-based clinics, rural health clinics, Indian Health Service and tribal clinics, and school-based clinics. From Union County to Coos County, from Prineville to Portland, these clinics spring forward from nearly every community in this state. We all have a common mission, that is to provide primary and preventive health care to the uninsured and those on the Oregon Health Plan in our communities. I am here today on their behalf, speaking with one voice to say that the safety net offers up its services in this time of crisis to help Oregon find a way out. Here's what we are seeing in our communities, and here's how we think we can help out. First off, we are very busy. Our waiting rooms are full. Most of our clinics are operating on expanded schedules and overtime to care for the increase over the last month alone in people coming to the safety net. These people are newly unemployed, newly uninsured, or newly displaced from the Oregon Health Plan in many cases, and in most cases, actually, and regular health coverage also. Some are newly homeless, and many are in crisis. All of those horror stories you have been hearing from your constituents affected by the budget cuts and a depressed economy are the people in our waiting rooms. We are where they go when everything else falls apart. We are the safety net. Figures I heard on Monday from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation placed the number of uninsured in Oregon at 420,000. The Oregon Primary Care Association calculates that the safety net's historic capacity to serve patients is a little over 150,000 individual patients a year. We believe that through local and state planning, the resources of the safety net can be leveraged and capacity strengthened and expanded to help address the state's health care crisis. The safety net clinics represent several hundred million dollars in local community support. Each clinic has deep and often passionate support from business leaders, faith-based institutions, the academic institutions, and the government leaders in their community. The safety net clinics also have the capacity to draw down federal match. Last year, there were three FQHC new starts in Oregon, one in Prineville, one in Astoria, and my own clinic in Portland. Each new start represents the initiation of an ongoing, increasing federal funding stream of almost $500,000 a year in pure grant dollars, and an increase in capacity to treat uninsured and Medicaid patients. Last year, Alaska, our more aggressive neighbor to the north, had 11 new starts. In Portland this year, something interesting is also happening. Both OHSU and Providence are participating in applications to become FQHC new starts for their mission clinics. If successful in joining the safety net, this brings to them an obligation to provide primary care, mental health, and substance abuse treatment to uninsured and Medicaid patients. It also provides them with an in-house capacity to divert costly inappropriate ER visits to their more cost-effective mission clinics, a model seen in other states, but not in our own before now. The healthcare safety net can bring these resources to the table. The state treasury may not have the money to pay everyone's health insurance, but the state can help leverage these federal funds, and it can structure the Oregon Health Plan in such a way as to maximize that leverage. In order to shore up capacity and maintain and grow these revenues and efficiencies, we need a vehicle. With the sponsorship of many people sitting here at this table today, Representative Bates, Vice Chair Representative March, Representative Greenlick, Representative Moniz Anderson, House Bill 2970 was introduced. I encourage the consideration and support of that bill. The healthcare safety net is not the only answer to Oregon's healthcare crisis. It does not address expensive end-of-life care or costly hospitalizations, though it will reduce unnecessary hospitalizations. From the clinics in your districts to the clinics at opposite ends of the state, we have one mission, to watch after the health of our people. You are our leaders, and the Healthcare Safety Net is here to offer you our passion, our skills, and our local and federal resources to help. In planful partnership, we can do so much more. Thank you.
Thank you. You're the, excuse the title, Executive Director or Director of Outside In?
I'm the current chair.
Current chair?
Oh, of Outside In?
Yeah.
I am the Medical Director.
Well, next time I'm up, please allow me to invite myself in.
Okay. You certainly are invited.
Passed it 20 times, and I ought to go in there. Well, now I know someone there, so please, if you see me on your doorstep, answer the ring.
He probably needs help.
As previously indicated, I've got to keep a prior request from the speaker. I do have a editorial comment. Many of you are here every day, and I appreciate that very much. I have checked with Phyllis's son, Warren, and he has indeed procured the Ozzy Osbourne tickets for Ellen Lowe. So the... and she was most appreciative. She is looking forward to this so much. So we'll keep you updated as to, you know, her progress as she progresses towards the big night, Ellen. Excuse me for about 15 minutes.
Could I? Representative Green, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a great pleasure to be here with my old friend, Ellen and I have been in the trenches on these issues for probably more years than she wants to admit. It is important to be reminded that the ultimate goal, is assuring that all Oregonians have access to health care, all Americans have access to health care. We've worked on that, and I was just reminded by it because the assumptions we used in the 1989 task force that created the Oregon Health Plan was that there were 400,000 uninsured in Oregon, and I was a little startled to hear we have 420,000 uninsured, although there are a lot more citizens. And we all need to recognize that we're living in sort of complicated times, very difficult times. Some of us are going to be out talking about revenue enhancements, others aren't. I mean, these are fairly complicated times. But if we continue to remind ourselves that the objective is to move towards health care for all Oregonians in some particularly Oregonian way, how do the things you're talking about, how can you put the things you're talking about in terms of our short-term objectives in that kind of a context? And which of those help move us? Which of those are just bailing the boat? And which of those move the boat towards the goal that I think so many of us have worked for all these years?
I'll address the ones that come to my attention. Certainly, revenue is very important. I'll leave the revenue for you to address. But I think working on the structure is also important. I speak from a safety net point of view. You could move my chair one seat to the left, all the way around the circle of all the providers in healthcare, each of them would have a different take from their point of view. But the solution, I think, has to be the same in the end, and that is that there is collaboration between the hospital systems, between the safety net, between the providers, and between the patients, between the insurance companies, care plans. All of them have different components of power and of interests, and we're in a logjam right now. And only through collaboration and finding ways that we are sharing the load, sharing the benefits, are we going to be able to do that. I believe that some of the things that I outlined today involve a partnership between state government and between the safety net. It's also going to necessitate a partnership between the hospitals. I think that these are very important. I think the Oregon Health Plan remains the coin of the realm, and that it needs to remain. That its dismemberment is going to cost far too much to be replaced. so I feel that that also is important to support.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I'm delighted you asked the question. I think our experience with the Oregon Health Plan truly was that the promise hasn't become the reality. And the promise was that we were going to focus on prevention. We cannot focus on prevention without primary care capacity, and it is not out there for this population. That is why I strongly support, as a first step, basically supporting and expanding the safety net. Because for the population of people who work in jobs from which they will be fired if they take a day off to take their child into a clinic, or who are in and out of jobs or in and out of homelessness, a traditional managed care or indemnity plan does not provide the kind of access that the safety net does as a primary care kind of front line. And I believe that you've heard before in this committee that, in fact, many safety net clinics are at capacity. They are not accepting new patients. Yesterday in Pioneer Courthouse Square, as part of Cover the Uninsured Week, I think there was a big effort to figure out which of the primary care clinics in Portland were accepting new patients so that the many people that we expected to see at the square who had no insurance could be directed to someplace where they could get care. And I believe your clinic was the only one that was able to accept new patients. Is that right?
I know we took some. I thought there was one other. That was the nurse practitioner clinic.
but limited, nevertheless.
Okay. And I would also add that on the purple sheet we gave you, since revenues are an issue, and since this was never intended to be public-only funded program, and since we know many employers have employees enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, there are two ways that are on this list for engaging employer participation in financing access for health care.
Okay, thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Towers, you spoke about how increasing the amount of taxes collected or through reduction in tax breaks, deductions, and so forth, just 1 cent would add $150 million. That is it's a theoretical concept. Have you looked at actual restructuring of a minimum tax applied to personal income tax as a way to take that theoretical concept into an actual proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, right now, you know, we're examining kind of how this might work in terms of how do you move from collecting 55 cents to 75 cents. Are you talking about to the minimum business tax or just minimum tax in general? Or
I'm speaking about your recognition that if we collect 56 cents rather than 55,
right,
we would increase income by 150 million. And how one actually takes that correct statistic and translates it into a workable proposal.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, I think that there's a couple different ways you can look at doing that. I mean, I think that the legislature as a whole can, again, do like what any family would do when they're faced with a terrible financial situation and start looking at the things that they're going to stop contributing to. Okay, so you can look at specific tax breaks that are being provided right now and start saving the money that way, or perhaps an across-the-board approach might be more reasonable. But fundamentally, I think that so many of the decisions about tax breaks are made in a vacuum that what we need is an approach where we are no longer looking at them in a vacuum, but instead as an overall approach where the impact of each individual break is looked at as a group.
Just follow on with one.
Well, if it's not about tax, yes, but we are a little limited for time, and we need to run the tax ones over to revenue.
Stay in contact with me on the resource side.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, you had said something about mission clinics becoming FQHCs, federally qualified health centers. where isn't their reimbursement rate, what is it, 100% if they're FQHC? I'm excited about that and would hope that every safety net could become an FQHC. Having gone through becoming an FQHC site in Clackamas County in the early 90s, extremely painful, the standards, et cetera, just give me your sense on how easy you think our smaller satellite clinics would be able to do that, because there's some way we could help and streamline and give assistance to make them come on board and become that. It would be wonderful.
Well, if anyone in the state is an expert on that question today, it's me. My clinic just became an FQHC this year. I received my grant last August. I am in the throes of the first year of that transformation. Prior to last August, I had been a small free clinic for the last 30 years. So we had a clinic in place, and we had our habits, and they were not the same as the expectations, the program expectations of the Bureau of Primary Health Care. So we have been working for a year to reconcile the two. I think the biggest hurdle to overcome is one of will and perception. And once you have overcome that, then everything else is just minor tasks to take one at a time. I've received a great deal of support from the Bureau. I've had two site visits of people coming out to help me figure out what to do, and we've moved along very easily, and I can see that we're going to arrive at the targets that we set when we initially undertook it. I believe that others can do that too. I was dumbfounded when I was in Alaska on a training from the Bureau recently to see that there were clinics that had received grants, homeless clinics that currently had no site. They didn't know where their homeless populations were in the cities that they were representing, and they had no providers yet, but they did have a medical director. And they had received a grant. And they were courageously moving forward, knowing that they had 2 years to be providing the expectations of what was there. And they seemed to believe that they could do it, and I suspect that they will do it. Great. So it can be accomplished.
Great. Good to hear.
Thank you. Any further questions? Great. Well, thank you very much. And if we have any time at the end, maybe we'll pursue more of the revenue issues. And next panel is a group of people who have been LHP enrollees, and they're here representing NAMI. And if you would come forward, please, and sign in. And now that you've been members of the audience, you know how hard it is to hear back there, so make sure you speak right into those microphones. This is the low-tech committee room. And welcome. For the record, if you would state your name before you speak, that way it gives our recorder and staff an ability to keep track of individuals.
No. Do we need to sign it first?
You can as each one of you speak, just say your name and go ahead with your story.
Okay, and we also have some.
Handout! Wonderful. Kelly will pick those up. That's great.
I'll go ahead and start. I guess. Representative March and the committee members, I'd like to thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Sandy Bumpus, and I'm a representative of NAMI as a family member. I live in Portland, Oregon, and have been doing a lot of work through NAMI of Multnomah County. I'm here today representing myself specifically as a family member, and also representing other family members who I have worked with who have children and young adults with mental health and substance or related disorders, which could include substance abuse or developmental disabilities. I personally have been advocating on behalf of my own child, who is now 19 years old, diagnosed at the age of 8 with a very complex history. He now has a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And I have to say we've had a lifetime of difficulty obtaining appropriate services for him. He is currently on the Oregon Health Plan. And as a result of the failure of Measure 28 and cuts by the Legislative Emergency Board in November of 2002, he now stands to lose his case. Well, he has already lost his case management services and stands to lose his individual therapy. And these things all collectively have barely been holding him together. He does take medication, and he's, you know, doing well as a result of that. But it's been very challenging to navigate through these last few months and figure out how we're going to continue to provide these services for him. As you, as a group, take on a challenge of coming up with some solutions or looking at what you're going to do with the Oregon Health Plan in the future, I just wanted to highlight a few points and ask you to consider these very seriously. First of all, medications alone are not enough. Medications are very helpful, and nowadays people with serious disorders like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in particular can become much more productive in their lives than they ever used to be. But they're not enough. And basically, best treatment practices nationally have indicated that intensive community-based services that are provided in an array of services and also that are consumer and family-centered are what really help these people to become better and what help them to, what else, these services also reduce the need for the higher-end costing services such as hospitalization and any of the criminal justice and other services that are very costly. In Multnomah County, been very involved in the community as they have tried to deal with the crisis there. A couple of years ago, they went through a redesign process. I was involved in the community at that point. This is all prior to September 11th. And at that time, there were very few community-based follow-up services available for people, not just children, but adults, who needed mental health or related services. And basically what was happening in that community, and I'm sure some of you are aware of that, is that the hospitalization that people were using over and over and over again, that was bleeding the system. There was a lot of concern among the leadership in that community that money would all go away if they were not able to do something to turn it around. And so a lot of work has been done to put more community-based services in place, but now, again, as a result of the economy and the cuts that we have looked at and have been seeing on a regular basis here, those services have gone away. So now we're looking at increased hospitalizations again, and again, you know, we're very concerned about that. I've learned that if my son is currently on open card, but if he were in the MHO, which is Verity in Multnomah County, he would only be seen on a crisis basis, emergency or crisis basis. So the very services that are barely holding him in place are keeping him out of that crisis. But those are going to go away, and pretty soon, I hope not, but pretty soon he may be at the level of crisis again. So we, you know, very concerned about this, and as I've made in my statement here, I believe this is cost shifting, and it is a lot more expensive to provide services this way. And the results in terms of the treatment, I hate to call it that because it's really not effective treatment to have people access services in the hospital constantly like that. Is not going to be as effective. So people are not going to be getting better. I also believe that I don't have any statistics to back this up at this point, but I also believe that we will see more costs shifted into the criminal justice system and the suicide rates in this state will go up significantly as a result of these cuts. Also, I think another solution that needs to be looked at is passing legislation for mental health parity. It is not the entire solution, but I think for many years now, NAMI has been very instrumental in trying to get legislation passed for mental health parity, and I can't remember which session this is, about the fourth or fifth session now that we have come to the legislature asking all of you to do that, and I think we have a Senate bill that's been floating around that sounds very promising. And this is the first time, well, this is not a hearing related to that bill specifically, but I understand that there will be some public testimony in which in the past there has not been any public testimony, any chance for any public comment about what that would do. The fact of the matter is that these mental health disorders are biologically based. They are on par with other major medical problems such as heart disease and diabetes. And it's very important that we see a positive result in getting that legislation passed. Finally, I guess the other point I would really like to make is that children with mental illness become adults with mental illness. We all hope that that doesn't happen, but a lot of times it does. And the scary thing is, sometimes, and I'm not pointing fingers here necessarily, but sometimes it really, from my observation and the work that I've been doing in the last few years and watching people make decisions around mental health services, it feels like we're so focused on the moment and on the dollar that we don't realize that cutting services in the way that they have been cut are going to interrupt important services down the road for some of the same people. And a perfect example is that the two-tier system now with the Oregon Health Plan, kids who age out of the children's mental health system will become OHP standard unless they have gone through a disability eligibility process such as SSI or Aging and Disability Services or something like that. That will interrupt their mental health benefits unless they have another funding mechanism to pay for that. That will be very tragic. Fortunately, in my situation, my son received his eligibility for SSI probably 2 months before that decision was made. Otherwise, he would be one of those OHP standard enrollees.
Without medication.
Without medication, without mental health support whatsoever. So all of the time, effort, energy that we have put into getting him help, all the time and energy the professionals have put into stabilizing him will have gone for nothing. And we would like to see that not happen. And that is one reason why I personally wanted to be here and speak with you today, is to remember that as you go forward and review the benefit package and the enrollee aspects of the Oregon Health Plan. With all of that, I guess the main point is, please do whatever you can to create stable funding for these services. We want to see them continue. Generally speaking, services under the Oregon Health Plan have worked. They have worked well. We would like to see that continue, and we know these are hard times, but we really... these are services that are very, very needed in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy. And maybe we'll go on to the next and finish the panel, and then people can ask questions of any of the three of you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Westland, members of the committee. My name is Allie Linfoot. I have a son, Jason, who is 11 years old. He is diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder.
Excuse me, Allie. Could you pull that mic just a little closer? Folks in the back are...
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
My son is diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder and Asperger's syndrome, which is a high-functioning form of autism. I'm not only here today to speak on my son's behalf, but also on the behalf of other families that face the same challenges that my family faces every day. I apologize that I am unable to sit here and recite statistics, but I'm not a lobbyist. I'm a married mother of three, college educated, who was laid off last year due to our economic downturn. With the additional proposed cuts to the Oregon Health Plan, children will be condemned to a life that revolves around crisis and emergency rooms. prescription drug benefits and hospitalization benefits are not enough in and of themselves. Yes, my son does need his medications to successfully function in school and at home, but he also needs the support of his psychiatrist and his therapist. There aren't any medications that are a silver bullet for these children. I also have a 15-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old daughter. Both of my daughters are very stable and successful, despite past exposure to their brother's violent outbursts. My 15-year-old attends Lincoln High School. She was hand-selected by the school to attend the International Studies program, and my 7-year-old daughter is your average first grader. She gets good grades and is progressing with the best of them. My point is, this is not a parenting issue. This is a brain disorder issue. I didn't ask for this for my son, and my son certainly did not ask for it for himself. Jason was not born with the hard wiring that enables him to form appropriate and functional relationships. He wasn't born with the hard wiring that dictates good decision-making and judgment. But with the therapy he's received through his psychiatrist and his therapist, he is learning these skills. There haven't been any suspensions from school in several months. He hasn't had any run-ins with the police in 18 months. And I am very grateful to these people for helping us. If these services are torn away from him, I am certain that he will eventually have a brush with the juvenile justice system. The skills that Jason has learned and is continuing to learn cannot be mastered in a hospital setting. These skills can only be taught and fine-tuned in the community. And make no mistake, Jason is very dedicated and understands the importance of these skills and the role that they will place once he reaches adulthood. Jason is very conscious of what goes on in his head, but he's unable to control it. These skills are and will be critical throughout his life. He needs these skills to be successful in school, and he will also need them to be an independent and productive adult, which I am sure he will turn out to be when he is older. This is a goal for all parents of special needs children. It is well documented by several studies that innovative community-based care that allows for housing, education, and community support is the most successful system of care for both children and adults. It has been documented that best practices are intensive community treatment. We need to end the residential carve-out for children. The carve-out keeps our children institutionalized. I understand that the residential providers are a strong lobby, but that does not make institutionalization effective or right for the long run. It is cheaper and more effective to use community-based care. The future cost of institutionalization will be enormous if the only service options for the mentally ill are hospitalization after hospitalization. Oregon has been the national leader in innovative care for its citizens. Oregon has been commended for its leaders' vision and forward thinking. Let's not lose sight of this vision. Let's not return our needy to the dark ages of institutionalization for the mentally ill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellie, and don't apologize for not having all the statistics. We get those numbers all the time, and you put a human face on that, and that's what we need to hear. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could expand on that, I was going to make exactly the same point that Ellie did express concern about not having all the statistics. And, you know, I mean, to the contrary, you know, we get lots of fact sheets with lots of data, most of it dueling data, but it is incredibly important that you are here today with your specific circumstance and your story, Jason's story. That's what this committee is here for today, and that's why, through the grace of God, you found your way here today. I really appreciate you being here, everyone.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Could we get the microphone over there for you? Thanks for the folks in back.
Thank you, Chair Westland, Vice Chair March, and the committee members. This is my first time in a situation like this. I only just became a citizen, so I'm very proud to be here.
Oh,
of all.
Oh. Well, welcome.
I was just going to deal with this, sorry. First of all, I brought you a statistic. This is my statistic. I'll pass it around. This is my son. He graduated from high school, a straight, well, not straight A student, but all AP courses, 3.75 GPA, $15,000 scholarship to Drew University on the East Coast, baseball player, perfectly normal, no signs of any illness. He came back after his first semester and told his father he was hearing voices. And that was the start of the horror that we have been through.
Could I interrupt just for a
Certainly.
Second? Could you state your name for the
I'm
record?
So sorry. My name is Dorothy Saucy.
Thank
spelled
you.
Saucy. And I'm from Newburgh, Oregon. And I'm an Army member and a parent.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Sorry about that. Anyway, he came back, went into hospital. He's been hospitalized 6 times over the past 5 years. And we started with private insurance. But what happened with that is private insurance doesn't give a wraparound service. They will provide some services. But it wasn't until he got into SSI and therefore the Oregon Health Plan that he started getting good services. I don't want to dwell on the past nightmare of the 5 years. I want to tell you what happened last October. In September, my son was really sick, thank you. And the police were called yet again, and he was taken yet again into emergency. But this time, after he was in hospital for about a month, I managed to get him into what they call telecare. This is a state program, which is very small, and it has made a huge difference to him. He's in college. The reason I was late was I was taking him to college. He begged me for a lift. Mothers never say no, right? Begged me for a lift, so I took him to college because he's doing his exams. He's doing exams. Up till now, stress exacerbated his symptoms, and he couldn't do it. The difference is that telecare has given him choices and has made him understand that he can manage this illness. He's now able to recognize that he is ill. He never could do that before. Without these kinds of services, with just putting people in hospital and then having them come out, at some point they're going to come off their meds. Their voices tell them, you don't need them. But somehow something clicked. And it's clicking for a lot of people, I'm told, by the people at telecare. I'm terrified that this will get cut because at some point he may have to go back into hospital. At this point, if he does that, there's a chance he may go back into telecare and it will be reinforced for him. So where before I saw nothing but blackness, I began to see light this fall. And then when I heard about these cuts, of course, I was devastated. So I'm here to beg you on behalf of my son and all the other people in his situation, perfectly normal people in all other regard, to help them. And I don't know how to do it, and I don't want your job, but I wish you all the best. And I would be very happy to give more taxes to be able to do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy. And could you maybe explain a little bit of how telecare works?
Well, what telecare does, I think, and it'd be better to ask them than me, is that first of all, you have to be committed to be able to go there. And usually you can't be responding well to medicines in a hospital environment. You have to either be in the state hospital or on the waiting list. Some brilliant person, Seth Lyons, managed to find some wiggle room because Charles actually was responding well and wasn't the norm to go into telecare. Managed to find some wiggle room and got him in. What telecare does is it tells the people there that they have choices. Because they're all on commitment, they're not allowed to go out and disappear into the night. But telecare says you can go out during the day and we'll see you tonight, expecting them to come back. If they don't come back, the consequence will be that the police go and pick them up because they're committed. But it's a natural consequence for the event. It's not someone saying, thou shalt be back for dinner at 6 o'clock. And that's just one little thing they do. They also do a lot of work with the families. I was amazed. I was invited in to have a discussion with them all. And it was very sweet because up till then, my son had refused to sign anything. So that was another whole piece of the puzzle, that when your son is committed and he's in hospital and you call the hospital, they say, we can't tell you if he's here. Another story. But anyway, he actually signed the release. So I'm not quite sure what they do, but I just said thank you very much. But I think the whole point is to give ownership to the person who is sick. Thank you.
Any other questions for any of the Dr. Bates? Oh,
thank you. First, I appreciate all three of you coming down here. I happen to be a physician, and I'm primary care. But I also have a second job in which I back up the emergency room at the local hospitals where I practice. And the revolving door of the severely and chronically medically mentally ill coming through those doors, and we actually have, we call them, as you probably know, frequent flyers.
Yes.
Because they come back and recycle through at huge costs, is very real, and you've put a very real face to it. We also know, though, that there are programs that have started in the state in the last few years that give what we call wraparound care. Mm-hmm. But once the patient has had that first psychiatric break, they then go into a wraparound program where they are carefully monitored and helped. And I think that's what you're describing. They have a place to live. There's someone to make certain they take their medications properly on the proper basis. They are held accountable for their actions, and they become accountable for their actions, and they become functioning members of our society. And I think that's what we're talking about here. Sandy, I had a question for you that came to my mind as you described your son. The basic model we've always used has been you are assigned to a physician or a care organization for your physical health. And then we carve out the mental health part of it if it's something severe. If it's a mild depression or mild anxiety, then the primary care physician takes care of that. And those two things become separate. And we've often felt that was an inefficient way of doing it. And it's been suggested recently by Dr. Goldberg and others that we should reverse that model, and that for people who have chronic severe mental illness, that their primary source of care should be their MHO, their mental health organization, and that organization should then direct their physical health, which would be the reverse of what we normally see. And my question to you is, how would that work for your son if he was involved in and being managed primarily for his schizophrenia, but that if he became a diabetic or he had bronchitis or something else, that they would contract him out to be taken care of for that physical illness? But the primary issue for him would be his mental illness, and that's where he would go for his primary care, so to speak. Is that something that would work?
That's a good question, because I think that's our challenge right now. And I guess ideally, and I think what Multnomah County had intended to do, and because of the economy suffering the way it has, it's been difficult to complete this. But ideally what should happen for a person like my son is that they should have an array of services that they have to choose from. So in his particular case, he feels that he needs to have a therapist he can work with, someone who he can talk to, as very important to him. And he should be able to choose who that therapist is. And the way that the carve-out works is that, depending on who's funding what, he may or may not be able to do that. But I think ideally, if you're talking about a wraparound service that is consumer, family-focused, the consumer should have a choice about who they receive that service from. And I don't know how to explain it any more than that. I don't know what other communities have done in that regard. I know that the difficulty in his particular case is that as long as he is on open card, he has the ability to see that person that he wants to see. The minute he becomes assigned to a provider, which is about to happen because I just recently was laid off of my job, so I'll be losing my health insurance. Which is how he was designated as open card. So then he'll have to choose a provider who will then dictate the services that he receives. And right now in Multnomah County, therapy is not an array of service. It's not one of the services that are being offered on that, in that organization. So I think, you know, you talk about, Ali talked about the carve-outs of the residential care, and I think there's always going to be some need for residential care. The difficulty in having carve-outs is we want to suggest that counties have accountability to not let kids or adults go into the higher end services. And when there's a state carve out, that accountability structure is not there. And that's where the difficulty lies. And we know this is a huge political issue, but we see it happening all of the time. So,
could I make a comment?
Please.
Just Sandy talking about how it's important for her son to have a therapist to talk to. I wanted to make the point that with my son, that also for him, and we have to remember he is only 11, but it's a safe place for him. He knows that he can say anything to that therapist, and there aren't any consequences. You know, he can go in there and tell her how angry he is with me, and she's not going to get angry back. It's a very safe place for him, and it's very important for him to be able to talk to her about those things. I have seen him pace our living room. We have wood floors, and we have a section that is in front of the TV where the finish has been worn off, because when he would get these angry feelings, he would pace and pace and clench his fists, and he didn't feel like he could talk to me because he didn't want to get into trouble. I mean, I'm still his mom, you know, and that is a role I have to play sometimes. So for him to be able to talk to somebody is very important. And there are times he asks me, when's my next appointment with Jan? You know? So I just wanted to make that point.
Thank
Can
you.
I make one last comment?
Please.
I'd like to respond to Representative Bates' comment about wraparound services. When Charles came out of telecare, the idea was that he went into what they call the ACT team, ACT team, which provided those wraparound services, and we've been very successful elsewhere, where they have psychiatrists and counselors and therapists and all sorts of people, housing people. Well, they've been cut by 50%, so their workload obviously has increased to the point that they can't manage to provide the wraparound services, and I saw Charles and his counselor last Monday, and the counselor turned to Charles and said, because you're doing reasonably well, I won't be able to contact you. I can only contact you in a crisis. So if you're in crisis, call me. Now, when someone with schizophrenia goes into crisis, the last thing they're going to do is call. So I could see that breaking down. I mean, it's just worthless. So that was my last comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I thank all three of you for coming in. And next we have Jackie Mercer, Tina Kotek, and Ellen Gradison. That's one. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Jackie Mercer. I'm the executive director for the Native American Rehabilitation Association, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be back here again today. I am a member of the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force, and serve on the Oregon Legislative Commission for Indian Services. And it's in that capacity that I'm here today to address you about several issues and concerns of the task force. We really appreciate the hard work and how difficult this is for you all. And as I was preparing my testimony and thinking about what I would say today, I just really sort of prayed that I would find something that would touch your heart and bring to mind some of the issues and some awareness that you have about the issues facing Oregon's racial and ethnic communities. We, as a task force, were formed 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and basically we're charged to look at several areas of health disparities. Those included access to health care, alcohol and drug treatment, diabetes, HIV, asthma, and lead. and lead poisoning. And I guess I, you know, in the interest of time today, I wanted to tell you just about a couple of those areas. The first of those is diabetes. And I think that some of the numbers are really pretty shocking. And while they're, you have to see them in numbers, it's really important to think about the people that are impacted by this. But for the general population, diabetes rate is about 5% of the population. But for the African American community, it's 13.5% of the community is diagnosed with diabetes. For the Native American community, it's 19.9%. In a worldwide statistic, for Native American people with diabetes is the most, is the group in the whole world that has the highest rate of diabetes. I think that one of the things that really sort of struck me as we were looking at the statistics again is that 30% of the people on dialysis are African American, while only representing less than 3% of the population of Oregon. And if you look at the number of people awaiting transplants, it's about 50% of the people. So what you're looking at is, again, is just the huge amount of disparity in healthcare. When our task force began, we were really concerned about access. We were really concerned about the disparities. And we recognized that in looking back at this time, that there was more access to care there then than there is now. And the largest group of people that will be impacted by the changes are the people in the standard population, because those are the adults and couples that have so much of the health disparities in front of them. For access, I guess one of the main things I would say is that 25% of the Latino community is uninsured, while for the sort of mainstream community, 14% is uninsured, just about two times as high. There's a huge percentage of people in the Latino and the Asian communities that need interpreters for health care and for access to care. So there's a tremendous amount of cultural and language barriers that prevent adequate care for folks. I think that one of the things that, you know, our task force has done over the last few years is to sort of look at several things, and there's been some legislation that has been passed that has created a health board licensing law that basically addresses the underrepresentation of the number of professionals of those communities, and trying to take a look at how many people are there and trying to work towards increasing those proportions. There has also been some legislation that has created standards for healthcare interpreters, and out of a project out of the Office of Multicultural Health, there were federal funds that were found to create a program to train bilingual and bicultural nurses in the state of Oregon. There's also been a strong effort, a statewide effort, towards analyzing and collecting data to sort of continue to show some of these health disparities. I think that, you know, I recently went to the National Council of Urban Indian Health meetings in D.C., and a couple of things that people said there just really sort of struck me. And one of those is that for Native American people, it's 740 times more likely that they'll die from alcohol-related problems. And that is just pretty amazing. I mean, those are really pretty epidemic kind of numbers. And the other number I'll mention for Native Americans is the suicide rate for boys 15 to 25 is 50 times general population. So we're looking at it, just incredible disparities that exist in the communities here in Oregon, and we recognize that it's easy to lose sight of these communities in the midst of this kind of crisis. And without an effort to really reach out to the communities in the planning and development of what may be newly constructed, will be lost again. So I guess it's sort of an appeal on the task force to consider these issues and to be inclusive in the development of any new plans and programs that might come out, so that we can increase access and we can have success, and that Oregon and you all can create a legacy where we begin to eliminate disparities.
Thank you. Any questions? Jackie, I'd urge your task force, if you have any specific recommendations on how we could work on some of those problems, particularly relating to your communities, please get it to us and feel free to submit it anytime.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, next.
That's as good as it gets.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tina Kotek, and I'm the Policy Director with Children First for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Heard some really great testimony. In the interest of time, I'll probably shorten my statement, but you have it all in front of you. Children First for Oregon is dedicated to the well-being of every child in Oregon, and we are a nonprofit, independent private organization that speaks on behalf of children in support of smart policy decisions. And we're particularly concerned about strengthening families and promoting stable, financially secure families, and we're concerned about the health and safety of children in the state. We recognize that there's a huge funding problem in the state and that you have a lot of hard work ahead of you. However, we were stunned to learn that one of the proposals that your work group has put forth is to reduce some of the eligible populations, namely to eliminate more than 20,000 children from the Oregon House Plan, nearly 3,000 pregnant women and newborn children, and 46,000 parents of low-income children who are on OHP. It was shocking to us. Not that we knew there weren't problems, but we didn't know what to say, and when we had the opportunity to come down today, we thought we better come down here because that's a problem. From a public health perspective, these cuts just jeopardize the health of children and families and, frankly, the future of Oregon. From a budget perspective, cutting these eligibility groups is short-sighted and fiscally irresponsible, and I'll get to that point in a second. And morally and ethically, we just think it's simply the wrong thing to do, and we would urge you not to cut those populations. What we know is that a child with health insurance is less costly to the state, critical to the overall public health and wellness of the state, and it's just sound public policy. In terms of the fiscal impact, one of the reasons that we're particularly concerned is we're talking about reducing the state's commitment to draw down children health insurance program funds, CHIC funds. When you cut off those 20,000 children, you lose federal revenue. You basically eliminate a set of eligibles that are fairly inexpensive to insure in many cases, and it takes money away from local communities. You'll see on page 2 of my testimony, it shows that for every dollar that the state invests, we draw down $2.57 in federal match. That's better than the regular Medicaid match. That's a lot of money. Currently, the governor's balanced budget talks about putting forth $12 million in general state funds to draw down $31 million in federal match for a total of $43 million. That's a good bargain. And when you talk about taking children off the program, you have to scratch your head and say, why are you doing that? Because this is money out there. It's there for the taking. Unfortunately, Oregon has not been successful in using all of its CHIP match. Currently, there's they have a untapped allotment of $171 million. So there's certainly lots of money there. In fact, my quick calculation was if the state put forth $66 million in state funds, they could pull down that $171 million in federal match. Second, we know that children cost less to insure. There's been a lot of expansion across the country in terms of CHIP, more children coming onto the program, but they've only amounted to 15% of the overall expenditure increase in Medicaid expenditures across the country. So children, if you focus on prevention and you make sure that they're seen when they need to be seen, they're going to cost you less than, say, some other populations. And finally, you've heard of this from other folks already, the economic consequences of cutting Medicaid spending in states. And in the little box there, it shows if we cut that $42 million that we're talking about in terms of CHIP dollars with match, you're losing $129 million in lost business activity, 1,350 lost jobs, and $47 million in lost salaries and wages. So the economic impact is a concern for us because we're concerned about, obviously, the economic stability of the state. So not only are you putting working families in jeopardy by reducing their access to health care for their children and many times the parents, but you're also reducing economic stimulus in these communities. You're taking away jobs, you're taking away salaries and wages. I go on to talk about why this is a public health issue, and I think when I was preparing this is kind of the no-brainer discussion here. I mean, healthy kids learn better, you cover them with health insurance, they have greater access to health care. And children, unlike some adults, most adults don't, children need to see doctors on a regular basis. There's a set They, you know, depending on their age, they need to be screened, see so many visits as they progress up through 18. And to guarantee the best possible health outcome, they need to see their physicians or have a health home to go to. So there's all kinds of reasons why health insurance for children, covering more children, is a good idea. Currently, from the 2000 figure, 70,000 children were uninsured in Oregon. I heard a number earlier. I think that number's up because of, obviously, the economic recession. So if it's around 100,000 now and you add another 20,000 children without health insurance, that's just unconscionable. I would urge you not to do that. And finally, the question was asked earlier, what are we talking about here? Frankly, you know, it's a choice about money. It's about making good public policy decisions. If there's a need out there, and there clearly is, it's about raising the revenue to meet the need. And when you, by cutting children off the program and not tapping into those CHIP dollars, it's also just fiscally unsound not to try to grab that higher match that you can get from CHIP dollars. And I think I'll conclude there if you have any questions for me. Like I said, I urge you to read the whole testimony, but that's kind of the highlights. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You did a great job in making the case, especially in terms of the CHIP kind of matches and the bang for the buck. Is it fair to summarize your testimony as saying that we do need overall more revenue, more dollars overall for healthcare needs in general, but that if we're going to look at targeting and prioritizing dollars, that dollars spent on CHIP are the best bang for the buck we're going to get? Is that a fair summary of your testimony?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I know Children First would never want to say that you should insure one population over another, but when you look strictly at the numbers, and it's not just children, you have some options with those CHIP dollars to cover other populations, I believe, and I'm not an expert, I'm new at this, but I think you can cover some adults with that, you can cover those pregnant women. I mean, there are other populations you can cover with the CHIP dollars, and frankly, it's a good source of revenue.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tina. I will just say I personally is also stunned and shocked, and as I know most of the committee members, to look at what the dollars that we were told were available bought, and it's not a pretty picture.
No.
Next. Could you grab that mic in? Thank you.
Hi. Ellen Gradison. I'm a staff attorney at the Oregon Law Center. I was on the waiver application steering committee.
old friends.
The access subcommittee of the Oregon Health Council, the task force on basic benefits that was put together a couple of years ago, and I'm on the governor's public health advisory board. I guess I'll just cut to the chase. You've heard a lot of testimony here. I think you need to identify, given the budget situation, the elements of the delivery system that are working. Now, I have never met Mr. Duke before, but he sat up here and told you that safety net clinics and FQHCs, community health centers, and so forth are working. We know they're working. They're culturally competent. They use funds more efficiently. I gave to Kelly a bunch of things that I don't have copies of for everybody. Okay, one of them is OPCA's numbers from a couple of years ago on Oregon Health Plan medical costs, FQHCs, versus all the other providers. They're more efficient. Okay. People who aren't eligible for Medicaid can be served in community clinics as well. For example, people who don't have the requisite alien status but who still work here for Oregon employers and support our economy, they have sliding fee scales. They have modest co-payments. They work. So examples of community clinics you already know about, community health centers, FQHCs, safety net clinics, school-based health centers, Indian health centers. Okay. So if you can identify a delivery system that works, then secondly, identify a basic benefit that can be accessed there. Okay, the task force on basic benefit plans, we met for, 6 or 8 months a couple years ago. We put together a report. Bob DePreet would have it. If you have Darren Kaufman would have it. I think it would serve everybody well if we took a good look at that again. That group was made up of Health Services Commission members, Oregon Health Council members, and other people that have been part of the healthcare debate for years. And it's a very well-reasoned, well-supported report. So some of this work has been done on basic benefits. I think preventative medicine and primary care, including physician services, some diagnostic services with guidelines, such as the Health Services Commission is talking about right now, outpatient mental health, chemical dependency services, and prescription drugs should be included, and health education. We don't hear enough about that. Health education is really important. You could have continuous enrollment without uninsurance. And the bottom line would be continuous access to basic preventative care and education. This isn't a fat plan. This is a very skinny plan, but it's going to help keep people out of ERs, which is obviously very expensive. Let's see, the UPR has reports. There's all kinds of reports. The role of the healthcare safety net clinics in Oregon. Oregon Health Council published a little report on that. What I gave her the covers of all these, and I don't know what you have, but it's been done. All we got to do is read it and look at it. Finally, if we can build a revenue base to support the delivery of this plan. This is a skinny plan, like I said, but if you can deliver it in a place where it's already being delivered well, you're not reinventing anything. I'm committed to working on this, and I could help in any way I can.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Westland.
Yeah. One for Tina at this juncture.
Yes.
In fact, two. Did I hear you say, this is a clarification on my part, that CHIP was included in the governor's balanced budget?
That is my understanding.
And it
Chair West.
May well have been, or at least a portion of it, and not to belabor what I'm sure you're probably already aware of, but I think by the time this is all said and done, I think as slim as the governor's balanced budget was first viewed, we will look back on that as the salad days.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make that comment, not that CHIP is a bad program, but that is the basis of my next question. And that is, you answered Representative Hunt's question pretty well in terms of, you know, the numbers and the value and the ability to have a higher leverage. But as public policymakers, you don't have to answer this question coming from where you come from, but as public policymakers, is it better policy to include an expanded population of children? And the numbers we were looking at is about 20,000 children for $12 million. Or is it better to take that $12 million and ensure the parents of those children that are already included under some of the federal Medicaid minimums?
That's a good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a question for Rick, if I could just get a clarification. Is that $12 million in general fund and then ramping up to 42, is that all coverage for children, or is that also the FEOP rollout?
Yeah, that's general fund.
Okay, but is it just for covering the 20,000 kids?
Roughly, yeah.
Roughly.
And the amount is, I understand, probably a little over 12,000 off or 20,000.
The 12 million is what we've got that we haven't allocated, or that we haven't got match for, or 12 million covers the amount of CHIP that currently is under the cap that we aren't getting.
Okay.
To the 185.
Okay. It's an interesting question about parents versus children. I think, from what I understand, studies show that if the parents aren't insured and the kids are insured, it makes it difficult for the children to make use of that insurance. On the other hand, if I were a parent, and I'm not, I would prefer to be able to take my child to get the treatment they need and having that health insurance. And it's often, my previous background is Oregon Food Bank, and that was the same case with food. Am I going to eat so I can be healthy to take care of my child, or am I going to give the food to my child? You're going to give the food to the child. And in terms of health insurance, you want to make sure they're covered. And my understanding with CHIP flexibility is you can cover the children, but also expand it to optional populations. Is that correct? To cover the parents as well, potentially?
I think you've got to be extraordinarily creative to get a small percentage of pregnant women that happen to be mothers. Is that right?
There's CHIP has more flexibility than Medicaid simply because it's a capped funding source, and there, but you do have to be a little bit slippery to do it, but it is doable.
When I would encourage innovation as much as possible. Going back to good public policy. I mean, I think one of the things we think is that good public policy is identifying the need and finding the money to meet the need. And it might not be the answer you're looking for, but the smartest decision, cover the children and the parents. You're going to have the best health outcomes.
You give her a choice of A and B, and she chooses C.
Very, very good. You'll make an excellent politician one day. Representative Greenlick, I know you have a question, but we have one more speaker. If you could maybe ask the person afterwards, would that work?
We're fine not to ask him.
No, we want to hear his question.
Well, if that's the wishes of the chair, I will go ahead and let us hear Representative Greenlick's question.
I'd like to ask Mr. Addison a question from the perspective of health policy again, and it links to a certain extent to the question I asked Ms. Penny before. I've worked since about 1967 to try and create a single healthcare system that encompasses all of us, as opposed to, say, the Latin American healthcare system, where there are three or sometimes four tiers, a healthcare system for the rich, a healthcare system for the employed, and a healthcare system for the poor. I think I heard your answer being, in the short term at least, a two-tiered healthcare system is fine. So we can have the employed and the rich and sort of one healthcare system, and then we can take the poor and stuff them into what's actually is working well, as you point out, our safety net system. Does that trouble you from a long-term policy perspective?
Absolutely. Thank you for that opportunity. Absolutely. I don't think things are getting better for the rich and the employed in the healthcare area. I think they're getting worse. And at some point, there may be a meeting here. But I would much rather see a basic benefit to those who are currently entirely disenfranchised than nothing at all. And I think if we can get some buy-in from a lot of the players on something on a floor, we could bring that up. At least we would be honest about what people were getting. And we'd be honest about requiring that there be access to something instead of pretending, as we do right now, in my view, for some of the members of the health plan, that they have access to something when, in fact, they don't, because they can't get a physician to take their part. So, I'm opposed to multi-tiers, but I'm more opposed to complete...
To nothing.
Exactly. I mean, it's like, what is it called when you... You have two horrible choices.
Hobson's choice. Yes. Thank you very much for testifying. And if any of you have anything else you want to submit in writing, please do. We have Maribeth Healy. Thank you for being patient, Maribeth.
Well, I guess this way I don't have to share the mic. And I will be brief. I know we're on a time crunch, as well as I don't want to be too repetitious. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Maribeth Healy, and I am the Director of Oregonians for Health Security, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregonians for Health Security is a coalitional organization that has been working to unite healthcare professionals, caregivers, consumer organizations, and concerned citizens to advocate for improved access to quality, affordable, and secure healthcare. Over the last year, we've been knocking on the doors of Oregonians to learn firsthand about the issues that they face in accessing healthcare. And from small business owners to healthcare workers without health insurance, Oregonians are concerned about their own health care and their neighbors' health care troubles. We also discovered that the Oregon Health Plan is a very popular program with voters, and that they are proud of Oregon's leadership on the health care issue and do not want to see us go backwards. And we do need to be very cautious about cutting OHP, especially in the current economic crisis. We've heard the figures, and I'll repeat them again because I do think that they are worth repeating, that every $1 million that we cut in Medicaid spending, Oregon loses 32 jobs and $3 million in related business activity. We cannot say that enough because this is an economic issue and an economic driver for our state. And according to a study published by the National Association of State Budget Officers and the Milbank Memorial Fund, the average state spending on health care was 27% in 1999, and in Oregon it was 20%. So clearly we're doing something right. And the Oregon Health Plan has been...
27% of what?
General budget, state budgets. Representative Greenlee, thank you. And OHP has been very successful. Since it began in 1994, over 1.4 million people have been served. Hospital charity care has declined 53%. Emergency room visits were lower than the national average. And Oregon ranks 44th in per capita health care costs, which is also much lower than the national average. So we should not go backwards. We know that ultimately people will access health care when they need it, but those that do not have health care coverage will wait until they are forced to go to the emergency room or required to stay in the hospital. And we all know that that is the most expensive type of care. So the Oregon Health Plan has reduced this need, and if we expand to cover more working families, we can make Oregon's health care system even more efficient. And a couple of ways to do that have been discussed today, and I'll go through them very briefly. And we should be looking at ways to control the costs and costs that don't deny access, like House Bill 3570, which Representative Montes Anderson and Representative Westland and a number of the committee are on already, which would create a purchasing pool for prescription medication in this state. Other states that have done it have seen that cost reduction greatly decrease in their state programs. Prescription drugs are one of the leading factors in the escalating costs of health care. So if we can reduce those costs, we can save money, expand access, and continue to be the national leader on health care. And you'll see a chart that is on page 3 of my testimony, which just shows, and this is from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that, you know, that prescription drug figure is not going down. It is going up and up and up, and there are many reasons for that, but we won't go into that today. And as you all know, OHP was originally designed to be a public-private partnership. So if we expand successful programs like FEOP, like the CHIP program, we can get more Oregonians covered and further reduce the costs of inefficiencies that are related to care received by the uninsured. So being creative, I'm back to that, it is a good way to draw down more federal money and to increase access through leveraging that additional federal health care money, especially for children. I'll do one more statistic on kids, and it is 1 out of 11 Oregon children have no health insurance. And so pulling that federal money down will allow us to keep the Oregon Health Plan healthy. And other options that folks, you know, and these are ideas that came about through our conversations with folks out in the community. You know, small business people who have seen the highest escalation in premiums, you know, that cost the average family premium is about $6,000 a year. So you have 10 employees at $60,000 a year. They would kill to be able to buy into the Oregon Health Plan at a much reduced rate. Again, strengthening it with the plan with a healthier pool of people, getting more public and private dollars in there. It just makes good economic sense. And those premium increases were 16.5% for small businesses. That's just a huge – nobody can do it, right? People who used to be able to provide health insurance for their employees are finding it more and more difficult, from small businesses to large, and this is an opportunity that we might be able to have. And again, I'm going to say that two-thirds of those that are uninsured are working. These are not people who are not taxpayers, and that is because employers are having a much more difficult time in being able to provide health insurance. So on the last page of my testimony, I have some vehicles, potential vehicles, I guess I should say, but legislative opportunities that this body, I am assuming, will be looking at that might help us as we look to recreate the Oregon Health Plan as a stronger plan to cover Oregonians. And in closing, I do want to thank the committee again and urge thoughtful consideration of the task before you, because it really is not an easy task. I am relatively new to the state of Oregon, and one of the reasons that I wanted to come here was because of the national reputation that Oregon had, really, both in providing quality public education for their kids. I have a 13-year-old, and just happened yesterday, so it's a little freaky, and also the health plan, right? My mother was like, oh, I think I'll come there. They seem to take care of their seniors really well there. I'm like, nah, ma, you know, hold on to your hat. Don't come yet. You know, it is important that the state is known nationally for its strong commitment to quality public services and a healthcare system and a terrific public education system. And I just think that the nation is watching Oregon, and we should continue to be the leader, particularly in healthcare policy. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Any questions?
Well, just a comment. Boy, does your timing suck.
Yeah, thank you. Although I will tell you that, although maybe I shouldn't, but I will say that I think the worst public school in this state is probably still better than some of the best public schools in the state I came from. So.
Well, and that's kind of a relative comment on my part, because, and while most states claim they're going through what Oregon is, and many of them are, we are the second most impacted state in the nation in terms of percent loss. So mm-hmm. I think we have a steeper, rockier road. But one question with regard to allowing small businesses to buy into the Oregon Health Plan.
Yes.
How do you propose compensating the physicians that lose money every time an Oregon Health Plan patient walks into their office?
You know, the reimbursement, Mr. Chair, thank you. The reimbursement issue is a big issue for providers, clearly. And I don't know that I necessarily know the answer. I would think that if we kind of put everything on the table and figure, I'm not a mathematician either, and figure out the math in this, I mean, maybe there's a way to do an increase in provider reimbursement. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that employers, small employers, were very intrigued with this opportunity, and the self-employed, of which there are many here, but I think Oregon is one of the leading states in terms of small business activity. 23-24% of the state is small business, so you know it makes sense to them to keep their employees.
The winners,
healthy.
Sure. I'm
right.
Talking about the losers. I'm talking about the people who are losing money every time an Oregon Health Plan patient walks into their door.
Well, can we do something on provider rates or reimbursement? That would be the other thing. Again, I think if there's more revenue in the system, there might be an opportunity to address that question. Because I do think whether it's obstetrics or someone on OBP or OHP, there are issues on the provider reimbursement.
Well, I've got to tell you, I heard this idea down at the Reed Opera House today for the first time, and I thought, oh, what a great idea. And I was about halfway home before I went, wait a minute, how, you know, I don't know, if you carve those people out. Keep coming up with ideas like that.
You broaden the pool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it helps in some regard.
You bring them in at a higher premium, and then you change the...
Or a special little rate for this given segment of reimbursement, where they're at least breaking even, and they're not showing up in the emergency room.
They could be OHP++.
Super plus.
Yeah. No, we could have platinum, OHP platinum. We have got to get out of here, because we're holding up a... another function.
All right. Mary Beth, thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee.
Any other business of the committee? None? Seeing none, we'll adjourn for the day.